Good morning. So in principle now, I have... Okay. Wow, people are still coming in. Okay, that's good. So let's see. So I've got a backup running right now. I've got record by desktop running. Well, we'll see how that runs. If my computer seems a little slow, that's probably why, because one core is being taken up by this. You all know the top command, right, in Linux? So if you don't know Linux, you should start playing with it. You'll see me in the course of my lectures doing things on Linux, and if you see me doing something, you go like, what the heck did he just do? Feel free to ask. It's important. So anyway, I got my Linux environment here. I'm a little annoyed that it's 1024 by 768, but I guess that's okay for playing it back. Yes? Make it louder? Oh, sorry. How's that? Okay. So I'm a bit annoyed the fact that, I don't know if you can tell, but everything is kind of squished wide. It's because the resolution is 1024 by 768, but yet it's in a widescreen aspect ratio. So everything looks kind of squished. But I think when you play this back from the capture, it might actually show in 1024 by 768 with a normal 4:3 aspect ratio. So I guess that's better if you're playing it back. It'll be a smaller window, and also it makes sure the text is bigger, so I shouldn't need to do as much zooming, but anyway. So in case you're curious, this is actually a box that's running Ubuntu 14.10 on this laptop. It's a dual boot with Windows 8. And my normal desktop is the regular Ubuntu, but I can't do screen capturing properly with the regular Ubuntu desktop because it's 3D accelerated. So I use the desktop that you all have in the virtual machine, which hopefully also will then... Which is hopefully helpful for you all as well. So now let's see. I got Emacs running, and there's one other program I really need, which would be Internet Firefox. For those of you who don't know, you can actually set up Firefox so it automatically starts and asks you different profiles. This is, I find, a very useful thing because I do all my banking in my finance profile and I don't do any other web browsing. This is important because there's a number of attacks against web applications, which you will learn about some of them as the term goes on, that make use of having one tab running a malicious website and another tab running your banking or other sensitive website. So if you separate them into a whole separate profile with a separate history and bookmarks and everything else, they can't touch each other. So a poor man's way of doing this is using one browser for one purpose and another browser for another purpose. But this is, I find, a little more elegant. And so then I have a nice clean set up without all of my crazy number of tabs for doing class. And you'll notice now, there we go. Always interesting to see, what is... Okay, that was interesting, that Ubuntu thing taking up. So that's enough of this. Let's switch this over. we don't really care. There was nothing interesting there. Let's go to the wiki. Let me give you a little preview of coming attractions. So assignment one is not up yet, but should be up within the next day. Tutorial one is up because that happens right after class, the first one. And so you will see here in this tutorial, this has some initial background on running the virtual machine. And then it has some stuff on, if you want to run it in things other than VirtualBox, then it has you for doing a little Hello World, then it has you creating a simple web app, and then it has you, observing, debugging the web app based on using some of the things that we did last time, and then has you make very simple changes, tells you about a few little scripts that let you save stuff from the virtual machine. So the idea of these scripts is they are based on something called rsync, and they basically synchronize your home directory from your virtual machine to a directory in your SES account. So save 246 synchronizes your entire home directory to SES, restore brings it back, compare sees whether there's differences between them. When you log into your virtual machine in the labs, I'd suggest running restore 246 if you'd put a save before, because then you immediately get back your old state if you want it, and then saves it. Now, for the actual class materials, you don't strictly need to do this because the labs will be separate, and I'll give you the code drop and everything for you to deal with on each assignment and each tutorial basis. But if you want to customize the environment, set up certain things in there, or if you want to keep some information around, that's the way to do it. The other way to do it, of course, if it's your own machine, is you don't have to bother with this whole thing because you'll already, the virtual machine when you shut down and restore will be the way it was. But this allows you to use the virtual, if you do the save and restore, then you can have work that you did at home, save it to the SES account, and then restore it when you get into the lab. So you can use the virtual machine at home and not have to carry your laptop in to campus to continue doing things. So anyway, you'll play with that in the lab. And then if you haven't started playing with Code Academy, use the rest of the time in here to start playing with Code Academy. So just to give you an idea, when you go to, let's just look at some of these. What I'm really wanting you to do, so if you go through here, HTML and CSS, you see there's this HTML basis. So this stuff, go through all of this. And the easiest way to do it is for each of these modules, you can actually go to any one of these, just click on it. You don't even have to log in if you don't want to like save your progress and things. You can just, okay, don't tell me again. Okay, start here. So you'll see this little tab here that tells you about things, and you can see all the different lessons. So you can actually go straight like to the review and like click on this and then just see what it's talking about. So you can skip ahead in any of the lectures and just see what they're talking about and go like, oh, I already know this. I don't need to do this. Or if you want to read some other sources online and stuff. But if you go through these in full detail at the pace they have you do them, it will take you many, many hours. But I'm thinking for most of you, it won't take that many hours because most of you have some background. And if not, you can look at this and go like, oh, I get it. I don't need to be told, how to print something. I can just skip ahead. I understand what semicolons are. C-like syntax. So the HTML, so it's not, this one's not going to take you 7 hours. It does, I'm concerned. But if you go through this so you should go through this entire one. You should, for JavaScript, I'll be talking a lot about JavaScript, but like things like introduction to for loops. They're for loops. I hope you know for loops. While loops, control flow, arrays and objects. This you might want to start paying attention a little bit, but we're going to be talking a lot more about the objects and things we'll be talking more about. But if you go through this, you'll at least see the basics. That'll be helpful. This is jQuery is useful to look through because this tells you some of the syntax, which makes things, which is a little nicer than the JavaScript stuff. And then the web projects, don't bother with the advanced projects unless you really want to, but the these are all really simple. So think of this all as warm-up, so I don't have to talk about the really boring stuff in class. If you get confused by something, ask questions of me or of the TAs. But ask questions. Speaking of that, I can get rid of these. Here. So if you look at the outline now, there are office hours. Woohoo! So So if you look at the office hours, we've tried to give more coverage in later in the week, since the tutorials are Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and since the assignments will be due on Sundays. So you'll notice that my office hours is Wednesdays 1 to 3. We've got, you know, we got Tuesday covered from 10 to 12, 2 to 4. We've got Fridays covered from 1 to 2, 4 to 5, 4:30 to 5:30, the very last office hours we can have, you know, during the week. Wednesday 3 to 5, so that's after my office hours 1 to 3. Thursday 12 to 2. So lots of opportunity to see TAs. Office hours start this week. So if you are having questions, go in early and ask questions, because don't get behind. For some of you, the class is starting out very slowly. For some of you, the class is starting out very fast. So keep up, because it accumulates. Now let's get on to Node and JavaScript, and let's talk about the web architecture here. So what we have with this class is we're going to be developing our own web server, and we're going to be using that web server to create a full web application. So what I mean by a web application, so let's go do some Node. No, that's not what I want. Okay. Is this text big enough? Can you read that in the back? Or should I make it bigger? Bigger? Okay. How about that? Good? Okay. So, I forgot. I need a volunteer. We're going to do sign-ups for the rest of the semester for note-taking, and we'll still figure out which TA is going to be managing that. Did anyone want to volunteer for today's lecture for taking notes? Okay, you'll do it. Sure. Okay. You can do it up to 3 times. Then it's over with. So a web page is HTML plus CSS plus JavaScript. HTML defines the structure of the page. CSS and the basic content. CSS is the styling of the web page. JavaScript is the code in the web page. When we talk about a web application, so a web application is some set of web pages, which are some combination of HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, plus some server-side logic. So there's something going on which changes how the web server responds to requests. Because web pages, okay, loading a web page. When you load a web page, browser sends an HTTP GET request. Server returns document. The document has references to other resources. That's not right. So the browser does gets for the other resources as well, in addition to just the first one. So you have to do gets of the images, of the embedded JavaScript, of the CSS, or everything. But first, what you get is this initial HTML document, and it gives references to everything else. Notice the gets for the references in the web page do not have to go to the original web server. They can go to other places. So for example, let's say you have a blog, and let's say you want to make money from it. So what do? You put ads on it. In order to insert ads, you will embed a little snippet of HTML JavaScript into your web page, which will cause things to be loaded from the ad servers, loading down images, loading down text, loading down whatever is needed in order to embed the advertisement in your web page. That's not your web server's job. That's someone else's web server. And in fact, in general, with modern web applications, your HTML and CSS and JavaScript in your web page are pulling resources from many different web servers. There's an originating web server, and then there's all the others. So, what does the server-side logic do? That's it. Well, and posts. Why this matters is a traditional web server just served files. It was a static web servers . So that means that in a static web server, when you get a response from HTTP GET, it's directly referring to a file on the web server. When there is a dynamic web server, you're saying an HTTP GET, and then it's going to run some code, which will then generate the response to the HTTP GET or the post. I'm emphasizing this at the beginning because I've noticed in past runs of this class this concept of where the division is between the client and the server gets confusing. Now, of course, what code is used to implement dynamic web servers? Just about every programming language known to man. There's all kinds of programming languages that are used for server-side logic. The original language that was used most was Perl. Perl was used for CGI scripts. Then there were, let me explain CGI scripts. So, early web servers. So, CGI stands for Common Gateway Interface, I think. But the idea of a CGI script was that it was a file that the web server, when it saw that file, it said, oh, I'm not supposed to just send this back to the browser. I'm supposed to run something on it. Would be a program. Server. So with the CGI extension for a web server, you'd run the script, and then the web server would run the script, and then it would return the output of that script. I was trying to decide whether I should show you a CGI script, but I think that will just confuse you. Anyway, it's a pretty reasonable model for adding, given that the web started with static web pages, CGI was a reasonable way of extending it to dynamic web pages. Can you think what the problem would be with having CGI for doing everything? We don't do CGI now, except in a legacy way. CGI is something generally you avoid. So CGI, the problem is, okay, this is, okay, this is getting annoying. I have function keys bound to certain keys, and those function keys are being taken over by full screen mode forget it. I'll figure that out later. So with CGI, you run a separate process for each web request, and no common state. Well, that's actually not so much about it. This is the big thing. The basic problem with CGI is you're running a program in response to every web request. And there's this inherent overhead with running a separate program in response for every web request. Because there's time it takes to start up a program. I mean, it's just like, how long does it take you to start up, a big application? You notice your computer grind or something. Especially if you have a slow hard disk, it takes a while for it to do all the initialization. Essentially, the program is booting up, and you have to pay that. Even if you cut it down, you still have to pay for that boot up cost every time you launch a script. So it's not a great architecture. And so there are ways to make it so that it's not, you don't pay that overhead. Solution. So this is normally used with PHP. So with something like PHP, you have the web server, typically Apache, would start up the PHP process and leave it running. And then when scripts come along, it would send it to the PHP process and have it run it and return the result. So it doesn't pay the overhead of executing it. Now, with something like Node, turns out most of the work is being done on the dynamic side anyway. And if you've got a programming language, how hard is it for a programming language to say, oh, let me load a file and send it off? It's not that hard. You might say, maybe it's kind of slow. But not if you optimize for that case. And it turns out JavaScript in something like Node is actually very fast. So we basically have eliminated that web server. So all we instead have is the Node process itself. So what does that mean? Well, let's bring up a web server from scratch. Okay, so how do I get a basic Node web server up? Well, one thing I can do is use Express, which I've installed. I can say, so what I've done right now is you'll notice on my desktop, it just created this thing here, which has a number of folders. So it has bin, public routes, views, app.js, package.json. So the idea is that this is your basic web app right here. No, yeah. So in a traditional web app, a traditional web server, so a static web server, it sends you the file you requested. With Node, you send input to the Node program, and it generates a web page for you and sends that back. That's the key difference. This is exactly the same thing that something like PHP does, except that PHP normally does not run as a standalone thing. It has to run in conjunction with a static web server such as Apache. Apache will fork off PHP, and PHP will do all the work. So, in fact, with this wiki right here, when you say index.php, why does it say index.php? It turns out that there is a file on my web server called index.php. And index.php is a program written in PHP. So the Apache web server on my box looks at that script and then says, oh, I should read that. Oh, let me just show you the program instead of telling you. Let me show you. Is this text big enough in this terminal? I can make this bigger. Bigger? Okay. Okay. Ooh. Okay. Preferences. I should use terminal font. How about 14? There we go. So, this is my desktop. This is the one that runs the wiki and stuff. So if we go into var lib so you look in var lib media wiki, you'll see index.php. This is where the PHP is actually here. So user share media wiki. So this is the code that gets run every time you access a page that the base page index is the main entry point for media wiki. So here you see this is PHP code, and it loads some other stuff and include web start. This code leads to other code, leads to other code. But this is what's being executed. But if you look at what's running on my system, there's a bunch of Apache processes. Apache, you know where the name Apache comes from? It's not actually a reference to any sort of Aboriginal group or anything. Although apparently they got some okay from it, and I think the Apache Foundation gives them some money, but. No, it does nothing to attack helicopters. It has to do with this. The Apache web server was based on the original NCSA HTTPD. So the original NCSA were the folks, National Center for Supercomputing Applications out of Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, UIUC. They made Mosaic. That was where Mark Andreessen was working on the first widespread web browser. They also made a web server to go with it, HTTPD. That web server got hacked on and hacked on and kept adding patches and patches and patches. And that eventually became Apache because it was Apache server. Yeah. Anyway, so that gives you an idea of how old and crufty. I mean, they've improved the code, and I'm not saying anything bad per se about Apache, except that it's the old way of doing things. It's a static web server, and so PHP still to this day wants something like Apache running, and PHP runs within the nice safe confines of Apache. And if you just load an image or load a static web page from an Apache web server, it'll just do its normal thing. But when you load something that ends in .php, it will run the PHP interpreter and use that to generate the actual HTML that you get. But with Node, that's not what we have. With Node, what we instead have is this thing, testApp. So what I do with Express, so Express, let me try explaining Express and Node. So to a first approximation, all Node is a JavaScript execution environment with networking and disk I.O. support. This with networking and disk I.O. support matters because the standard JavaScript language definition doesn't have those things. You might go like, what? No, this relates to the fact that JavaScript was designed to run inside of a web browser, so it's designed to be limited in its power. If JavaScript had too much power, you could potentially programmed to do things like basically do arbitrary things for attackers. So JavaScript in a browser is limited in what it can do, but if you want it to be a web server, you don't want to limit what it can do. So you add in things for doing network and disk I.O. support. But at that level, you should think of it as really like Java. It's pretty basic. So on top, so Node by itself does Node by itself doesn't have much functionality at all. We add modules to make it better. We use a lot this program called NPM when we do things with Node because that's what allows us to load in all the other code that Node depends upon. And you want, because you don't want to be editing all this from scratch. So what? Have you all been exposed to frameworks as a general idea in software engineering? So most of the time when you create an application, so a framework, I've got some keyboard issues here. So when you have to structure an application, you've got to put a lot of, there's some basic structure that you have normally to your application. You have to architect and say, where is this code going to go? Where is that going to go? You've heard about Model View Controller. So Model View Controller is a design pattern for a lot of applications. If you're going to implement Model View Controller, you're then going to have to structure your code and say, okay, well, I need to make a file for where my models are going to go, or maybe a directory for all the files that will refer to my model. And then I'm going to have certain objects that are going to be my model, and then other things that are going to be my view and what is my controller. And you have to spend some time thinking about how to lay this out. Turns out this is a bit of a waste of time for large classes of applications because there are standard ways of doing these things. And if you invent your own way of structuring things, you confuse everyone else who's ever going to program, going to modify your app. So standardize. Do it in the basic way. So if there's a standard way of doing it, programmers are lazy. Why not auto-generate it? So that's all. Programming framework allows you typically to generate automatically a very simple application that runs, but doesn't do much. And then you add in your functionality into that. And it also provides the additional code and support to allow you to extend the framework to do whatever you want. Now, you might find yourself building an application which doesn't fit within a specific framework. If that's the case, you can break the framework or switch frameworks. Switching frameworks, if you already have a pre-developed application, is painful. But breaking the framework you can generally do if you need to, but it then makes everyone's life harder who has to then work on your code. So it's important to pick the right framework when you initially are building your application. Now, in this class, we're building web applications. The basic framework's pretty straightforward. So just use it. And that's what Express is. So what does that mean? Here's your basic web app. App.js contains the main code that you're going to be running. This package tells what the dependencies are of this code. And then, oh look, you have views. Model view controller. This is basically your views. Your routes is essentially your model. In your controller kind of thing. And your model, they basically go in routes because since it's a website, you know, it's a web application, routes means when I receive a certain request, forget, what do I do in response? That's what the routes are. Yes? I'm saying this is the basic framework that was created by Express. So I just type in, so this is actually called Express Generator. Yeah, what you do is you modify this. So that means you take your app.js, you may modify this, and then you go into routes, and you maybe modify these files or add them, or you add things in views, you want more new views, you add them in here, and you follow this. This is, it gives you a basic structure. For a complex web app, are you going to have to extend this and, you know, make more structure? Oh, certainly yes. But this will be more than enough for the purposes of this class. You won't have to add too much to this. Now, there's two other things that are kind of cool here. Well, this bin is actually the thing you run. This is the top level script. What they've done in the earlier versions of Express, everything was put into app.js. Now they factored out the parts that you shouldn't have to mess with and put them into the bin www, and you run that. And app.js contains the stuff that are more likely to modify. But then there's this public. What do you think this public directory is? Public, so it's probably accessible in some way. Well, this is, anything you put in here, static web server. Node includes a static web server. Well, Node by itself doesn't include static web server. Node provides the mechanisms for implementing a static web server. The Express framework provides a static web server. So you don't need to implement it yourself. You want to do things that a static web server would do? Just dump them in public. Oh, look, put images here. Put your CSS files here. Put any sort of JavaScript stuff that can run the client in here. Done. Very simple. So that's one of the nice. Now, do you have to use all this? No. You might be wondering, well, okay, how much code am I depending upon here? How much stuff in addition to Node am I going to need? Well, turns out that if I just type this right now and try running it, it's not going to work. It's not going to work because the dependencies have not been installed. So when you normally install a binary from a program in a lot of operating systems and stuff, it needs libraries and other things that have to be included, and they'll be installed all over the place in your system if it's like a Linux box. If you're running it on Windows, you'll have a directory and all the libraries might be there, or maybe they'll put some libraries in the Windows directory or something, Windows system or something. So dependencies, sometimes they're all centralized, sometimes they're all over the place. With Node, by convention, all of the dependencies, all the other code that you need will live in this directory. in a node modules directory. A node underscore modules directory will contain all the other code other than the base node installation that your application depends upon. So what this means is in order to move node applications from one place to the other, you just have to move this entire directory. It contains everything you need as long as node is installed. But that means you also get to see exactly how much code it depends on. So let's go ahead and bring in all those dependencies. Let's go. So what we do is do npm install. So first let me do... So if you look at package.json, this tells you all the dependencies. Oh, look, it depends on Express, it depends on body parser, cookie parser, Morgan, surf, avicon, debug, jade. Those are all packages. And what's even better is these packages depend upon their own packages. It's recursive. So inside, what will happen is in your node modules directory, you'll get all of these, and inside of each of those directories will have their own node modules directories for their dependencies. And you might say, well, Express depends on something that also Morgan depends upon. So does it unify them? No, you'll have two copies of them. You might say, oh, that sounds bad. Well, it turns out these two things might depend upon different versions of the same library. And so they'll both run fine, happily. It might seem like a recipe for chaos, but actually it's a pretty nice strategy. Code duplication is actually better than having things break. And memory and disk space are relatively cheap nowadays. So what do we do now? We do npm install. So now it's running there. I think that you can give a dash V so you can see what it's actually doing. But right now it's churning. You see the little cursor spin, spin, spin. Come on. Here we go. And that's what, and this tells you the results of its action. So it says this is what we've all got here, the versions and everything of what we downloaded. So now if we look, oh look, there's a node modules directory. And let's go into node modules. Oh look, body parser, cookie parser, debug, Express, Jade, Morgan. What does Express depend upon? Oh, it's got its own node modules. Oh, it's got all these. Got that. So you might be curious, how much code is this? Eleven megs of code. Just that's what it depends upon. So, but as a result of this, what can I do now? I can now run my web server. So, I have a web server running. Okay. How do I tell this web server running? Well, I better connect to it. Let's go to my web browser. Woo! We're up. So what does this localhost :3000 mean? What does localhost refer to? Yep. Localhost is always your machine. It's the host name of your machine. Localhost is really useful for doing development like this because you don't have to worry about, oh, what's my IP address? Oh, what server am I connecting to or whatever. I mean, it's localhost. So in this class in general, we'll be doing everything through localhost because you'll be developing and testing and running all in the same box. But you might say, well, is this a real web server? Well, I think you should be able to test this. So by the way, oh look here, by default, what it will do is when you run this, it will actually tell you what's been happening. Oh look, there was a get for slash, and it gave a 304. And it says it already had a cached version of it. The browser did, because the page hasn't changed. Then get style sheet style 200. That means that was okay. 404, you don't have any fab icons. Anyone know what fab icons are? It's this little thingy. Well, I don't know if Fab icons aren't even shown a lot of times, but the idea is with a little icon thing that shows up at the corner of your browser beside things. Let me see this. If I go to /, does it have a Fab icon still? Oh, wow. Even /, doesn't. It used to be you'd see a little dot slash there, /. Not anymore. So this is running. Now, if you're curious, I'll leave this up now for during the break. So this machine is at 134.117.220.90. So if you go to 134.117.290. What? 222? Was that right? Okay. Yep. No, 222.90. 222.9. Thank you. 222.90. :3000. You should be able to do that from any of your boxes. Can you do it from your phone? Can you access this? 134.117.222.90. But you have to enter the :3000. The reason you have to enter the :3000 is because this is not listening on the standard port of 80. It's listening to the standard. And let's just look. Oh, let's see those connections coming. Whoa! So the reason I'm doing this, I'm saying this is a real web server. It is running. There's nothing, I mean, could you take exactly this and put it up on some hosting provider and have it show, welcome to Express? Yes. The technology's all there, it's all the same thing, and, you know, yeah, it works. So. Mm-hmm. :3000 is the standard development port we'll be using. The standard port for most web servers is 80. You normally do not use port 80 when you're developing a web server, but there's a one, as you'll see in the lab, it's like one little change to make it port 80. It's very easy to make it port 80. The reason we don't use port 80 is because normally to connect to port 80, particularly on Unix or Mac boxes, you have to have privileges. You have to run as root or something in order to connect to port 80. So you don't want to run with privileges while you're developing things. You know, who knows what your code's going to do? You want to limit its damage. So I'm saying that's the standard port that's specified for Node. That's the default development port. But I can set it to whatever the heck I want. So I'm going to pause here for a couple of minutes. We're at 10:53. I'll pause here for 5 minutes. You all can play with the website for a few minutes, and then we will continue on. Okay, let's go ahead and get started here. So I think I got it recording again, which is good. I see some of you are trying to get some other URLs, and you should be getting 404 messages. Anyway, let's kill this. And let's go on to... So first off, Fab, I pointed out, the Fab icon's there. Here's a Fab icon. This thing in particular tells you security information for the website. The site does not supply any identity information. We'll talk about that later. That's a separate whole discussion. Now what I want to discuss is JavaScript. So how many of you have heard various rants about JavaScript? People not liking JavaScript? So what are some of the reasons you've heard for not liking JavaScript? Okay, so weakly typed. Actually, I would say loosely typed. Weak implies a value judgment. It's a different way of doing things. It's not to say there aren't types. This is true. We'll talk about the potential benefits of that or downsides. Other issues with JavaScript. I mean, there's lots of languages that are loosely typed. You know, Python is, PHP is. I mean, there's a million languages that are like this. Yeah, there's weird globals. We'll discuss this. There are some bugs. There are some issues there. And dynamic this. Okay. Weird globals. Weird this. Yep. Yeah. So, as I've explained, as I mentioned earlier, JavaScript is a That's the most thing important to know about JavaScript. JavaScript is the first draft of a great language. But it's the first draft. What that means is that there's certain weirdnesses, and there's more of them. And in fact, this is one of the things that we're going to go through as we go through the book JavaScript, the Good Parts. One of the big ideas behind JavaScript, the Good Parts is saying you have to cut away a lot of the stuff in the language and ignore certain mechanisms and use certain conventions in order to get at the pretty good language that's inside of this, hiding underneath the mistakes. You might say, well, why don't you fix it? Remember the whole referrer thing? You can fix it, but it would be a different language, and that's not the language computers running web browsers run. First rule in the web is compatibility. What's the use of putting something on the web if people can't view it, render it, whatever? That's why you put it out there. So compatibility reigns supreme, and to break compatibility is a really painful thing, and people really don't want to do it unless they have to, and they want to do it in ways that are the least traumatic. Changing some of these semantic bits change fundamental ways on how the language works, which most of the time won't mess you up, but I'm sure. But there's always some little bit of code that depends upon it. You might say, fix the code. If anyone tells you in programming that the solution to a big problem is fix the code, they're saying that they don't know how to solve the problem. Because here's the sad part about programming. You basically never fix the code. You do. You fix code. You add in patches. You improve it. You refactor. You do other things. But basically, the code's always broken. And you're always going to have things that you want to fix that you can't fix. And the reason you do not fix them is because you will break the code. They might go, wait, why don't I do this? Why don't I change this? If I just reorganize this and refactor this function and put it over there, it's going to work exactly the same way. No, it won't. It probably will. In 99% of the cases, for every test case you run, then you put it out in production, and then there'll be some weird little situation that'll come up that will break your code. And that will cause your company to lose business. Or worse, people to die. This sort of stuff happens. You know, I mean, software. You might think, oh, my software is not going to kill anyone. Well, don't be so sure about that, especially since we're getting to the Internet of Things. I would go on about this, but just say You make code work, but you don't, that fixing it, making it right, no, you just sort of make it work. So JavaScript is a key example of this. It's a first draft of a great language. It's the first draft. It has mistakes. You got to deal. I'm sorry. But it does have some great ideas in it. And the great ideas of JavaScript come from some other really interesting languages, but it's very different from what you're used to. C-like syntax. It looks kind of like C. Loosely typed. What does that mean? You don't specify types for variables. It's not to say they don't have types. So if you have I, and in one part of the code is referring to a number, in another part of the code, it can be referring to a function. Okay. Here's one. Numbers are all there are no integers in JavaScript. Every number you use is a floating point number. They're all doubles. It's not to say the underlying runtime can't optimize it down to integers and do various things to say, oh, this is actually an int, it will do things. But from a programmer's perspective, it's all floats. It's kind of weird. But remember, JavaScript had this weird thing of it wanted to be easy for anyone to use. They wanted people to be able to pick up programming in JavaScript very quickly. So how do you explain to people that, oh, this is a number. Oh, but this can only, has to be whole numbers, and but you have to do this, and then you can have fractional and have decimals and things. That just makes things more confusing. So numbers are all doubles. They're all floats. I say doubles, they're double precision floats. So, get over it. Okay, that's really annoying. So it's object oriented, but it's not just object oriented. Row to no classes. It's a prototype-based object language, not a class-based object language. So this sort of difference might seem like, what? Wait. You got objects, but you have no classes? So what this means is you make an object. And if you want to make, you can make more objects and stuff, but every object, inheritance is by saying, oh, I want to be like that object. I want to inherit the functionality of that other object. There's no set of classes with a hierarchy with polymorphism. It's, you can do all those kind of things you want to do in a classic object-oriented language with classes, but it's different. And the reason why prototypes make sense is because there is no compile phase. You just run the code. You'll see this as we go. We're going to talk a lot more about JavaScript. Right now, I'm just sort of giving you some highlights of some, whoa, that's kind of strange. Now, lexical scoping, all lexical scoping means is that the range in which a variable can be seen is determined by how nested it is. Where is it in the function? Lexical means like it's where it's printed. This is as opposed to something called dynamic scoping. This might seem like the right way of doing things and the normal way, and this is in fact the way C and stuff works. But in a dynamic language, it gets a little weird because you can create new variables, new instances all the time. And their duration is a little funny to understand unless you study this a little more. And we're going to spend a good amount of time with this. So we're going to have to learn something called the environment model in order to understand how variables work in JavaScript. I'm trying to think of where, let's start with that. So let's bring up a terminal with Java, with, there we go. Terminal, let's minimize this. So let's just type node. I have a prompt. What can I do here? Oh, I can do 2 + 2. Yay. JavaScript prompt. So now the thing when I say that there is lexical scoping and there's something weird I said about globals, here's what I mean. How did I do that? I don't understand that. So let's define a function. So let's say f equals, okay, this is really going to bug me here. Oh, I know why. It's tap to click. That's why. All right. Function. So f. F is a function. This is what you expect. Right? Now let's do something a little stranger. Let's now define, instead of f, we're going to go g. X plus a. So g of 2 is what? A is not defined. A equals 3. Okay, so G, so G is using this variable A, which appears to be a global variable, right? This is all to here now. Everything basically looks like C, except I didn't declare anything. I didn't put any variable, any types in for the variables. Otherwise, it basically looks like C. But now let's do H. I do that right function h. Okay, now I should have gotten to something that you go like, that does not look like C anymore. If I run h, What will h return? H returns a function. So if I have a h of 3, I get back a function. Okay. Let's say h of 3. Let's make this h of 7. Make this q equals h of 7. Q is a function. Q of 2 returns what? 9. What's A? A is 3. So think about this thing. Now let me make A 2. Oh, sorry. Oh, that's not what I want. There we go. So now I again do this. Q hasn't changed the output. But if I go up here to, wasn't it G? So notice if I change A in the global environment, G changes. Can I change the return value of Q anymore? I have to change the value of h. Can I ever change? So let's make a function. Let's make p. Now, p equals h of 20. P of 3 is 23. Q of 6 is 13. So what happened here? Q is H of 7. P is H of 20. They both are referring to their own A. But their A's are different. This is what I'm talking about when I talk about lexical scoping. The A that is true when this code is run is remembered. In effect, this function here, when it's defined, gets a little snapshot of everything that's in its current context. That's why it's called its environment model. That's in its environment. It gets that A. That's tied into it. And every time you run this, it'll get another own instantiation of this. The global environment gets a little weird because it's always the same. But otherwise, these other ones are dynamically generated and change every time and can't be accessed. There is no way, unless I break into the JavaScript interpreter, to me to ever change what P is going to return. There is no way for me to change what Q is going to return. Those values of A are now fixed for all time. Now, I can redefine Q. I could say Q is equal to something else. I can make Q equal to 5 now. Now, can I do Q of 2? No, because Q is a number now. Now, that old function that Q used to refer to, does it still exist? Potentially. But I have no way of accessing it. In the language of a dynamic language, it's called, in the terminology of a dynamic language, this is called garbage. The function has become garbage. It is now not able to be referenced by any identifier. And so, it will be reclaimed, either now or later. If you don't understand what I just did, don't worry. It's perfectly fine. We're going to go through this multiple times in multiple ways. The reason why I'm doing this right now is more to push you out of your comfort zone and so that when you go through the JavaScript stuff, when you go through the tutorials, you'll look through that code and you'll go like, oh my God, this isn't actually getting at the interesting stuff. Because it's not. Most of the tutorials you'll see online that say, oh, learn JavaScript. They won't have anything close to this code. And if you learn Java and you learn C, you'll never see code like this. This is part of the stuff that we have to cover in this class in order for you to understand really how to program with JavaScript. Any quick questions? Enjoy tutorial.